So the title of this evening's talk is Cultivating Compassion in Relation to the Foundation Teachings of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. So I spoke last time about compassion, and a little bit more recent, more modern way, I suppose. But tonight I wanted to connect the teaching about compassion, the topic of compassion and cultivating compassion, with the more foundation teachings, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. I don't think that maybe often enough we don't mention and don't really take time to realize how much compassion is there, the teaching at the very beginning. Sometimes the three big traditions of Buddhism are kind of thought of as maybe the Theravada style and the foundation teachings, more perhaps about renunciation, Zen maybe more focusing on emptiness, and Tibetan tradition more focusing on compassion. However, when you begin to study them all, you realize all that is part of each and is included in the whole path. Renunciation, teachings on no self and emptiness, and compassion, beginning, middle, and end. In fact, the reason we have in our era of the eons of time that the Buddha's teachings talk about, we even have these teachings from our historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, is through a request and a response of compassion. The Buddha, after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, reflected upon the truth that he had seen and thought that perhaps there wasn't anybody who was going to be able to understand it. But then they say a Brahma came down from the God realms, the Brahma realms, and made a formal request for the Buddha to teach, and he said that perhaps there would be some beings who didn't have quite as much dust in their eyes who might be able to understand the teaching. So we can look at this as he made this formal request, and it was in the direction of compassion to of course that's how you speak to a being like a Buddha. You don't say, these teachings are just great and you're the best and nobody else has gone this far, even though that may be true. But you don't speak to an egoless being. You don't try to appeal to their ego. It's not going to happen, right? But what is true is the Buddha nature itself, the Buddha, the awakened one, the energy that is there is compassion. In fact, we're taught that the energy that radiates is the four Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So that from that kind of request, a being made up of compassion, love, joy, equanimity, pure light, responds to that. So right away we're taught that, we see that as the beginning reaching out to us across 2,500 years, compassion for us, that we're in need of these teachings, and we might be able to get enough dust out of our eyes that we might be able to follow the teachings. And then when the Buddha told his monastics, the monks and the nuns, to teach, this is what he said: go forth for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, the good, and the happiness of gods and men. Let no two of you go in the same direction. Teach the Dharma, which is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful at the end. Proclaim both the letter and the spirit of the holy life, completely fulfilled and perfectly pure. So again, his request, motivation: go forth for the good of the many, the happiness of the many, and out of compassion for the world. So we see in the early teachings definitely a strong, strong emphasis on compassion. And then, of course, we look at the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and right there at the beginning, suffering and the end of suffering, the teaching, just as compassion is related to suffering. If we're just talking to beings who spend 200,000 years in enlightened realms, we wouldn't say we have to teach compassion. But the situation that we're in the earth realm, is, and as humans and animals and those suffering in lower realms, is that there is suffering here. So, of course, the teaching responds to that right away. So, right at the beginning there. So I wanted to look at, when we look at the Eightfold Path, which comes as the fourth of the Noble Truths, right? So we have the truth of suffering, and then the cause of suffering. This is what the Buddha saw and taught. Causes: craving, clinging, attachment. And that would be bad news if he'd stop there. But then the third is that there is a possibility out of this. And then the fourth truth declared the path, which is the Eightfold Path. And then in that Eightfold Path, there are various ways of looking at it. And one of the main ways is to divide those eight items, the eight fields of training, into three fields, three categories of training: sila, samadhi, and panya. So sila is emphasized, we call that translated as ethics or morality. Another way to look at sila is that it's referring to the quality of our being and the cultivation of the true beauty of a person, which is this inner beauty. So we have the three of the Eightfold Path: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Or we'd say wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And those three comprise the training in sila, in ethics, morality, and the cultivation of the true beauty of a human being. So we'll look at that in relation to compassion. And then samadhi, in the Eightfold Path, that would be the three: right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Or wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. Samadhi also has a quality of courage in it, of cultivating courageousness. And then the training in panya is the training in wisdom, in Sanskrit prajna, wisdom, deep wisdom, capital W, wisdom. And the two on the path, the Eightfold Path, would be right understanding and right thought. So I want to look at these from the light of compassion as the teaching, the path, the practice, and also the result. It's just a nice little different way to look. So if we take this first field of training, sila, ethics, morality, the quality of our being, and we could say, we could maybe summarize this in saying that this is the practice of non-harming, the development of the energy, the intention, the beauty of non-harming, the beauty of the quality of non-harming. So we see that on the lists, and we think about, oh, developing ethics, you know, or we have the list and so forth, looking at those kinds of things. If we look from the angle of developing compassion, the quality of compassion in the heart, then we see that it is actually, as we begin to feel compassion, the result is this feeling and intention not to want to harm beings, other beings, or ourselves. Why does compassion do this? Well, because compassion is about being willing to see and understand suffering. Being willing to care about pain, the pain of others and our own pain. Last time when I was here, I talked about how we often close up to that because we have the mistaken notion, anxiety, fear, that if we let in pain, then we'll have to do something about it, we'll have to fix it. And we are already maybe overwhelmed in our lives, so the idea of doing that, it just would seem like too much. But we realize that's a misunderstanding, that it doesn't necessarily mean we have to fix things. And in fact, very often when we're in difficulty or distress and we tell others, not only are we not asking for them to fix it, it often feels a little bit intrusive if they immediately kind of jump in and say, oh, well, yeah, that sounds terrible, and here's what you should do. Because that's not what we were asking for. We were just asking for care, compassion, for someone to say, I'm sorry. A little comfort, really. So we think about that, and we realize that we can open our hearts to the pain of others and even to our own pain with the sense of offering care, caring, concern. Stephen Levine would say, tender-hearted mercy. A sense of reaching out from the heart to connect, to be together with someone in their difficulty. So we see that ethic of non-harming, and we realize that once we begin to sense our own pain and the pain of others, the situation of suffering on the planet, the situation of dukkha, as we become a bit more sensitive to that, our hearts open to that, then the next thing that happens is just this wish not to harm. We don't want to cause any more additional burden to others or to ourselves than the difficulties that come up in life already. This also is, of course, a result of loving kindness practice as well. As the heart of friendliness grows in us, we also begin to include more others in our heart's family. Sometimes they call metta, they don't translate it as loving kindness, they translate it as friendly feelings. I like that. That's nice too. Friendly feelings, cultivating friendly feelings. So then, friendly feelings, of course, there is this feeling, this sensibility of non-harming, which then turns the mind and the heart in the direction more and more of ethical behavior and of the precepts and of just contemplating what causes harm, what causes suffering. And in fact, then we see that taking us in the direction of the teachings on the laws of karma. Karma is cause and effect, and beginning to realize that all of our actions have consequences. And as we reflect on that teaching and look again at cause and effect, at action and consequence, friendly, warm feelings of our heart are there from our practice of loving kindness. The intelligence of our seeing clearly in our mindfulness practice, we realize that suffering often has a cause that we can see. Often it doesn't, but so often it does. And again, we find ourselves lining up with the intention to not be the cause of suffering for others and also for ourselves. Again, our meditation practice begins to reveal to us some insight into the nature of our own suffering and where we might have the option for choices, for changing actions that would have harmful consequences to ourselves as well as to others. When we look at the precepts then, again the training in sila, often the Buddhist precepts, if we look at them from this shining this light of compassion, the heart of compassion, we can see, of course, with the practice of right speech. Sometimes when we're starting just on the path, we want to kind of know the rules and regulations. I think it's we come from Judeo-Christian social background, and so we kind of want to know the commandments. So we make lists, you know, well, right speech is da-da-da, and it's da-da-da, and it's not da-da-da. And kind of this feeling inside of following the rules. But if we let the flavor of compassion and loving kindness come out, come to us, then when we begin to speak, we can feel this intention again not to cause harm through our speech. And then we begin to reflect on that, where our speech might be causing harm, and how we might change that with this flavor. Instead of the flavor of we want to just follow the rules and be good, which not a bad motivation either, really. It's often the way things are. But this other flavor emerges, which is, again, non-harming, to not cause suffering for others, for ourselves. And when we look at the teachings and the trainings around right speech, we see that. We see this flavor. Well, you know, gossip can cause suffering. You know? And certainly saying what isn't true can cause suffering to others or to ourselves. So it gets this flavor of the heart in it that actually makes it a little bit easier to do, to refrain from speech that would cause suffering. Right speech, speaking what's true and useful. So that sense out of loving kindness, out of compassion, to speak what's true and useful. Sometimes people get a little bit, they just say, well, right speech, speak the truth. But we want to add that extra one, what's true and useful. Because there's a lot of truth that is not useful and causes harm. So we can pay attention. This is all, you know, it takes time, practice, clear seeing, looking, some insight. These are things, it takes a while. Of course, not to kill, not to harm. We've talked about that, non-harming. Not taking what has not been offered, that's the monastic, that we say for us lay people, not taking what does not belong to us. The monastics take it one other step, and they can't take anything that hasn't been directly offered to them, which is kind of an amazing practice. It can be fun to experiment with that a little bit, but understand that as a lay person, you know, we don't quite take it that far. But when you see the monastics, if they don't get offered, the Theravada monastics, if they don't get offered food, they don't eat. Whew. That's something, huh? That's really something. To just decide that, take that vow for the rest of your life. If you don't get offered food, you're not going to eat. It's pretty amazing, the strict vows in the Theravada monastics. But to not take what doesn't belong to, I don't know, I'm awash in double negatives now. we're not taking what does not belong. We're not stealing stuff. There we go. Get my update 21st century language. So again, this imbuing that with a flavor of compassion out of kindness to ourselves, kindness to others, also kind of a sensibility about our own karma, and that actions have consequences that we will experience. There's a flavor of compassion that can make that kind of more natural, start to become more natural to us. And then causing harm with sexuality, of course. Sexuality, a very powerful thing. And then, once again, if we just think of that as a list of do's and don'ts, in this case, don't, can be a little dry. But once we imbue that with this sense and notion of cultivating compassion for ourselves, for others, then, again, harmlessness, the intention not to cause harm. And, of course, intoxicants and drugs that cause heedlessness. Once again, this sense of, as we engage on this path, we want to pay attention. We want to be able to pay attention more and more. So, of course, we wouldn't want to get in states of mind that would keep us from being able to pay attention. And we can see the harm those states can cause. And again, out of compassion for ourselves and others, we don't want to cause that harm. So the flavor of the precepts, the precepts can be imbued with the flavor of compassion, the energy of compassion. And then as we develop this sense of being committed to the notion of compassion, to care about suffering, to care about harmlessness, and to express that, we also give what is one of the great gifts, the practice, the path, taught to give the gift of fearlessness to others. Give others the gift of not having to fear us. To know that they're safe with us. A gift of trust that we can give others. And considering again the way life is in the modern world, people are under a lot of stress. The world is getting more and more crowded. And there is a lot of difficulty and danger. So if people are able to trust as we come together, it's so wonderful to be with a group of Dharma practitioners, people who know and have agreed their practice is these precepts. I often tell the story of being at IMS years ago on staff and escorting people to their rooms as part of the first day of retreat, showing people to their rooms, and how when the New Year's retreat is full of a lot of people from New York City. And I took one time one young man to his room and showed him where it was, and we had his bags, we set them in there, and he looked at me, kind of a funny look, and said, "I don't suppose there's a key." And I laughed, and I said, "No, no keys." And that's just something extraordinary if you live in New York City. You know, you come on retreat, and the doors, there's no locking of the doors. That everybody on the retreat is committed to that practice and trusting each other, not to take other people's belongings. So to give that gift of not having to fear the others that you're with really pointed that out that moment quite, you know, I'd been living there a long time, so I was kind of used to it, but it's something. It's really something. So sila, with the light of compassion, training in sila and ethical behavior, and the beauty that is inside of human beings from the light of compassion. And then the next field of training, samadhi. So this samadhi, the cultivation of samadhi, the word samadhi, is path of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So we think of it as cultivating effort, and then sometimes it's called energy, and sometimes it's referred to also as the courage in our practice, and then mindfulness or awareness, and then concentration or focus. Sometimes it's called focus. So this is interesting. When we think of right effort and energy and then courage, sometimes for me, the notion of compassion, then for motivation, for doing the practice when we're on retreat or when we're meditating and it gets difficult, or in life when it gets difficult. If I'm just somehow coming out of it as thinking of it as just for me, sometimes it's a little bit hard to connect with an energy of courage or effort. And then as you go along and you get, like I'm in my fifth decade, 45 years of practice, so the sense of me does erode, I'll tell you. It really gets very, very thin. And then, which is a wonderful thing, you know, part of the practice. But on the other side of it, if you don't have a strong sense of me, sometimes it's accessing motivation. It's sort of like, well, who? I can't find her. But if we say this path is for the compassion, for the sake of others, so that I could maybe get a little bit better at helping others in some way lessen their suffering, I can find that. We look at the world and we see the suffering of others. And so there is that courage and that energy to keep going. Just keep going, so that maybe one could develop a little bit better ability to help others, to serve others, to free others from difficulty, distress, and suffering. That brings energy and courage. And then, of course, our training in mindfulness and awareness, again, that sense of seeing what's actually happening, and realizing that people need help. They need support. They need care in this world. There are things people don't need. We don't need selfishness. We don't need others to be selfish. There's just too many of us here and too few resources, you know? So to have mindfulness, to have awareness, to train in that, again, for the sake of doing some good in this world, in this life. And then concentration or focus. Now, you may have heard different teachings on sometimes talk about three big categories of types of psychological types, the Buddhist psychological types, you know, and they spring, people describing these, it springs from the teaching on that there are people, that there are these three main energies, of course, greed, aversion, and delusion. And so most of us, all of us are mixtures of all three. But some of us could say that we have a very strong predominant one of those, you know, so that aversion or anger is strong for some folks. Desire is the strongest one for others. There's a group of us that delusion is the strongest. So it's just, it's a karmic thing, really. You can be incredibly intelligent and still be quite deluded. It's not the Western word, the term delusion. It's more this quality of mind which, also manifests as confusion or kind of vagueness. Sharon Salzberg is a famous dominantly deluded type. She tells very funny stories about what that's like. One of the things that if you have this, there can be a lack of focus. And so personally, for me, to have the notion of just even beginning to train in compassion, loving kindness, compassion. This is what brought me to the four Brahmaviharas so strongly, was because while I absolutely love the intensive practice, and I particularly like the Burmese style, you know, kind of the really intensive on retreat, and fortunately for me, I'm a strong concentrator. So you can be a deluded type and still be a strong concentrator, and it really feels good if you're generally kind of foggy to actually find a way to be really focused in that way. So I just loved retreat practice. I mean, I've been on a massive amount of retreats considering I didn't have much money. I was just a Dharma bum most of my life, but I think it was the joy of that kind of focus. And then though, moving into, daily life, again, experiencing that sense of where is the focus? And for me, to focus on cultivating the four Brahmaviharas, and then this theme of compassion, which is, as you know, I love the teachings of the Dalai Lama so much because there's so much emphasis on compassion. So for me, that training, that part of samadhi training in daily life really brings me to focus. Because honestly, I can be very... there's a lovely thing that can happen in practice, which is my present Tibetan teacher, Sonyi Rinpoche, calls it happiness for no reason. And it's really wonderful, you know, after a number of decades in practice, finally this kind of feeling can be arising for you quite often, happiness for no reason. And it's a lovely kind of contentment, sort of joyful feeling that can just be coming up. But again, if you don't have any focus, it can be just sort of a kind of a la 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 la. And so sometimes I can get in that kind of mood, that flavor, and then the thing that focuses me is wait a minute, you've got sitting group, you've got a talk to give, you've got, you know, you focus here. This is, again, it's for the sake of others. You know, you want to get a little better at this if you possibly can, maybe to transmit a little bit more clearly, or like when I love to teach the beginner retreats because my background of being on staff in all kinds of different positions and retreats, as well as my practice background, really allows me to give beginners a lot of helpful information. And so there's this sense of wanting to be of use to them, on their path of Dharma, because the path is the one thing that has just been so precious to me in my life. So focus, compassion, and cultivating it, and also learning about it, because as you begin to study compassion, you realize that it's a very, it's kind of complicated in the sense that we need to refine our intentions when we're learning about compassion, and also understand how easily we could fall into overwhelm, and what we can do, how we can train so as we don't fall into overwhelm. Or we can have motivations that are loving and kind, but they could have a flavor of grasping, attachment, those kinds of things. So it's a long journey, and a very wonderful yet demanding sort of training to begin to even glimpse at this compassion that they call immeasurable compassion, or Mahakaruna, the compassion of a Buddha, the profundity of that, just to begin to get a glimpse of that. But it provides a wonderful focus, wonderful motivation. And then when we see our various areas of mindfulness training, so we do mindfulness of thoughts. I don't know, without compassion, when you start seeing what's going on in there, it's a little bit daunting, isn't it? I remember one time some thought came into my mind on a retreat, and I wanted to stand up and say, "Who thought that? You know, that couldn't possibly have come from me." You know, so we really, again, with a flavor of compassion, that sense of, wow, you know, we're carrying some really weird stuff in here. And the kindness, the willingness, the patience, compassion has a lot of patience in it as well. To see these things, it's not personal, really. It's just what's in there, and touch that, the thoughts, with compassion. And then also with some discernment, so that we understand, we use, again, our focus, our awareness, our insight training to discern about what thoughts to act on and what ones not to act on, for sure. And then, of course, again, our mindfulness of emotions. We need tremendous compassion, and compassion helps us as we become aware of the range of emotions, and again, the harm that they can cause ourselves and others. And then also to bring forth the beautiful emotions. Our reactivity, of course, dramatic reactivity. Again, in the original teachings now, we don't have any teachings about driving. This is a great modern world arena for training, particularly in compassion. I mean, when we see what goes on in our minds and our hearts when someone cuts in front of us, a complete stranger, we behave as though they woke up this morning, they said, okay, at 4:25, Jude is going to be on I-5, and I am going to just cut right in front of her, so she has to hit the brakes, adrenaline pounds, I'm just doing that to her today. I mean, that's how we react, you know, the things we yell at the other people when they cut in front of us and so forth. But really, it's not it at all. We're all driving at 65 miles an hour in these gigantic machines down this freeway. It's a situation not faced in the Buddha's time, but faced day to day by us. And so to have that, to have a sense of compassion for others, for ourselves, for the whole situation, very, very much a part of our training in mindfulness, awareness, and compassion on that particular road, that particular path, the 65-mile-an-hour path of practice. Very important place where we can. So then we move to wisdom, panya, panya prajna. The path of wisdom, seeing the dukkha in the world, the Four Noble Truths, seeing the suffering, then how else could we possibly respond but with compassion? Otherwise, we're just kind of frozen because there's a lot of it there. But if we can then immediately bring forth this compassion for ourselves and for others, and this gentle friendliness of metta, the friendly feelings, the sense of kindness, then we can move forward again. Then we can act with wisdom. We want to see what's true without blame, and then to begin to see the cause of suffering. And when we begin on our path to see the root causes of suffering, and we realize that people are just out there with no sense of cause and effect, no sense of what they are actually doing to create their own suffering, no sense of the choices they might have to lessen suffering, the only response to that is compassion. The only response where we can maintain some sanity is compassion. So again, seeing wisdom and compassion, the teaching is they're the two wings. The Dharma is like a bird, and the two wings are wisdom and compassion. You can't fly with just one wing. So of course they are together. Wisdom is compassion. Compassion is wisdom. Compassion is the active energy of wisdom in the world. Once we see clearly, we act with compassion, we reach out, so that more and more, you know, on the path of this practice, when we're not on retreat, when we're not in meditative practice, the heart wants to help. And so many in this group, so many activities reaching out to help the world, to help friends, to help the society, to help the world. Another thing that touches us, that is our teaching in this wisdom, is seeing impermanence. So as we progress on the path, we see more and more clearly the truth of impermanence. Nothing stays. Everything that arises passes away. And to see that clearly, once again, the only response then is compassion. Compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. We see people, it's like trying to grab a reflection in the water. People trying to make something solid, something permanent, something lasting, in a world where none of that is true. The only response then is compassion. The only response that's sane. Trungpa Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher, used to talk of basic sanity. This path brings us basic sanity. And compassion, when we see what's really going on, is the basic sanity. It's the only response that we can have. To care about others, to care about ourselves, to care about suffering, to be concerned and to act. And then to continue our path with concern for others, with care for others. Wisdom sees clearly. And then compassion is the activity. I wanted to share with you a few quotes. I have a little time to do that. Something Sharon Salzberg in a dialogue, very clear. Sharon said, the traditional definition from the Pali, the language of the original texts in Buddhism, is that compassion is the trembling or quivering of the heart in response to pain or to suffering. Compassion is the natural response to clear seeing, to clear understanding. So then the interviewer says, so compassion is the recognition of the interconnectedness of everything? And Sharon says, it's the result of the recognition. In traditional terms, the recognition, impermanence / interconnectedness, the recognition itself is wisdom, and the result of that recognition is compassion. So, compassion is an active energy. It's what brings us back into the world to reach out and to help. Again, I think of the Buddha, this being, realized being, standing. He stood for a week and basically was thanking the tree and reflecting on everything that he had realized in the three watches of the night of his enlightenment. And in that reflection, thinking, I don't know if anybody's going to get this. It's really hard. And then a Brahma from the Brahma realm coming and making this formal request that he teach out of compassion for the suffering in the world. And so then the movement, the Buddha begins to walk, to go forth and to teach. And then from that day onward for decades, responding with compassion to anyone that came to him for teaching. They say he taught 84,000 different techniques. It's wonderful, I guess, I don't know, to be around at the time of a Buddha, where a Buddha could just look at you for a moment and know exactly the technique that would bring you from zero to enlightenment in 7 seconds. Really, just a wonderful, wonderful thing. I have so many other goodies here, but I don't have... another thing from Sharon, though. Another juicy one from Sharon. Now, if you've been able to go to her teachings when she comes here, she is so brilliant and incredibly unassuming. She and Joseph were my teachers at IMS for a long time. And at the retreats, she just so very low-key. And then there'd be a question-answer period. Sharon would, the teachers would alternate in the long retreats, these question-answers. So when Sharon was there, and someone would ask a question, and she again, just quietly, she'd just start to talk, and I would always just be stunned at how brilliant she is. Just this beautiful Dharma flowing forth, just very easily, no energy of ego or anything like that, but just beautiful, clear, clear Dharma. Okay, so again, in this interview, she's responding to something. This comes back to the Buddhist teaching about action and the different components of action. From the Buddhist perspective, you can divide an action into three parts. The first and most significant part is the intention underlying the action, the motivation from which it springs. When we talk about compassion and loving kindness, we're really talking about motivation. We're talking about the energetic field out of which we act and move. The second part is the skillfulness with which we act. For example, someone, you may have a beautiful motivation and want to say something lovingly to someone else. Skillfulness might involve determining whether this is best said privately or shouted across a room. The third part is the immediate result, or the result that we can see. And so Buddhism emphasizes transforming this process so that your intention comes from a place of love and compassion. Then you empower your skillfulness by paying attention. And then you let go of the immediate result with equanimity and peace. For example, we give a gesture, giving someone something, and we're sort of expecting that we get a lot of thanks and some kind of praise or acknowledgement. And then maybe they don't thank us, or worse yet, they thank the wrong person. You know? Wait a minute, I was the one who, you know, I did that. So, but with this watching intention and skillfulness, and then we want to let go with equanimity. So it's a beautiful way of looking at the development of the energy of compassion and motivation for compassion. Okay, I only have a few more minutes. So I you know, Dalai Lama, he's my guy. I have to bring in a little bit. His latest, one of his latest books, he writes about a book a month, I don't know. he and Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, are in some kind of race for how many books can be written. So one of the most recent ones is Toward a True Kinship of Faiths. And I just want to close. The Dalai Lama has been delighted to be studying, as well as everything else he studies, all the other religions of the world, and finding commonalities. And in this, he kind of reports on results in that study. And so there's a few quotes here from different religions about tradition, about compassion. So from the world's sacred scriptures, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." So that's from the Beatitudes in the Christian tradition. And then from Muhammad, "All creatures are God's children, and those dearest to God are those who treat his children kindly." And then from a Mahayana sutra, "Sentient beings trapped in aging and sickness are tormented by a hundred pains. Seeing them assailed by the terrors of birth, death, and sorrow, he directs his conduct for their weal." Bodhisattva. "Sentient beings crushed by the wheels of suffering within the circle of birth and death, seeing this, the Bodhisattva seeks the thunderbolt of wisdom that smashes to dust these wheels of woe." And from Zoroastrianism, "That nature alone is good, which refrains from doing to another whatsoever is not good for oneself." And in Hinduism, "This is the sum of duty. Do not unto others what you would not have them do unto you." That's in the Mahabharata. And in Judaism, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. This is the entire law. The rest is commentary." And Buddhism, "Since others too care for their own selves, those who care for themselves should not hurt others." And in Jainism, "A man should wander about treating all creatures as he himself would be treated." And in Taoism, "Regard your neighbor's gain as your gain, and your neighbor's loss as your own loss." Confucianism, "Do not do to others what you would not like yourself. Then there will be no resentment against you, either in the family or in the state." And again, Matthew in Christianity, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and its prophets." And in Islam, "No one of you is a believer until he desires for his brother that which he desires for himself." It's a lot more. It's a lovely book. And if you like audio, it's recorded, and the person who reads it is our dear Richard Gere. Lovely voice in your ear. So there's more here, but we're done with time. So just knowing in our heart this warmth, tenderness, friendliness, kindness, mercy, caring for ourselves and caring for others, compassion. This is our mission, Karuna, Maha Karuna. May all beings be free of suffering and find happiness. Thank you.